Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Claudia Monticelli and another episode of the Pleasure Seeking Podcast. And today I have an interesting guest. It's a first for me. Talking with him previously, I mentioned, you know, I haven't had people like you on my show yet. We've had sex therapists, we've had all kinds of people, adventurous souls. But today my guest is Brian Russell. Brian Russell is an author. He's a professor of biblical studies. And this is why I was so interested in having him come on. Because when you study at a level of a doctoral level, at a PhD level, you know a few things, and you're able to speak with them from authority. He's also a podcaster and a transformational coach for spiritually minded professionals and pastors. His personal mission is to seek out, to study, and embody the deepest truths about God, so that he can share them compellingly, lovingly, and transformationally with us. And this is what I'm after from him. And we'll be talking about many different things with him. Come on in, Brian, and I want you to talk for yourself. Speak for yourself.
Hi, Brian. Hey, Claudia, it's so great to be with you, and thanks for the opportunity.
Oh, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. It's such a pleasure for me because, you know, I'm a person who works with language, and specifically when I hear a person's voice, I know everything about them. I mean, I know, wow. If I don't want them, but as soon as I heard your voice, I thought, what, this is going to be heaven. It's heaven. Brian, wow. I know that we're in different time zones. You're on the East Coast in the United States, in California, I believe, right?
Well, actually, I'm in Orlando, so I'm a little closer, but yeah, I'm down in Florida in Orlando.
Orlando. We don't have an Orlando in Italy, but it's pretty close.
No, that's true. Orlando is a unique place for sure.
And one of the things that I would like to start to talk about with you that I've also written quite a bit about in my upcoming book is the notion of fear. And we all have what I call four faces of fear. I work with archetypes, and you speak about overcoming fear and more importantly, guilt and shame. And they're just different shades of that same coin. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit, and just beware, I will be interrupting every now and then.
No, that's great. It's fun to have a great conversation. So I'm ready for any interruptions or whatever. So yeah, for me, fear, guilt, and shame, I call them the unholy trinity. Again, you know, your listeners know I come at things from a religious perspective. And I've just found in my own life, and as I've gotten more tuned in and met with students and folks that I coach with, that most people struggle to show up fully as the person that I believe that each one of us was created to be, because
a moment, Brian, when you say they show up, what do you mean? They come out or they emerge or they show themselves to be?
Oh, I mean, when I mean show up is like the way that we live. So like when I popped on, you had an immediate impression about my voice. Yes, so yeah, I mean, but fear, guilt, and shame cause most of us to live lives that are much smaller than they should be. And so when I think that the shorthand for fear, guilt, and shame for me would be fear is I don't have enough. Guilt is I don't do enough. And shame is I'm just flat out not enough, or I'm not good enough. And so when I think about fear, I think of that, a lot of it is biological responses, right? Because so for survival, but in our modern world, again, depending on where you live, you know, we're not getting chased around by tigers, or we're not really struggling to find, you know, food. Like in the United States, if I'm hungry, I can go to McDonald's, I can go to a grocery store and all those things, but we still have those embedded fears that then show up as stress and such. So I've just noticed a lot of people are stuck and live smaller lives just because they're afraid that they're not going to have enough. Whereas in fact, the world is again, it can be scary and it can be dangerous, but there's an abundance available for everybody if we can just overcome our own fear that that might not be true for us.
Yeah. The notion of guilt, what is the core of that? Where do you think that stems from?
Yeah, in my own thinking, I distinguish between two kinds of guilt. Like I think there is true guilt, which for me would be if I've actually harmed someone or even harmed myself. Yes, I mean, it's completely appropriate to feel guilty about that. But what I've noticed is there's a more insidious form of guilt, and this is what causes us to live small. It's I would call it a false guilt that comes from somehow on the inside. We feel like we don't do enough based on maybe what our parents taught us, what society's expectations are, or even in my own head, what I think I should be doing versus what I am doing. And so one of the things I help people is to move past should and to make my life about like, I want to like today, it's like, let's see. You know, I should make space to talk to Claudia this afternoon versus like this morning, I looked at my calendar. I'm like, wow, I get to be on Claudia's podcast. So there's no should about this for me. It's I turned it into a must. I always tell people in terms of guilt, I want to get people to the space where they don't do anything they think they should do. Yeah. They just do stuff that they have chosen to do based on who they are and what they sense their mission is in life. And guilt blocks that because we live somebody else's life.
Well, that, you know, listening to you explain that, it makes me think that we're really two sides to the same coin. I look to the pleasure aspect of doing things that helps me overcome a lot of what I should do.
Right.
And shame. Now, shame is a particular beast that, to this day, I have trouble understanding. I have two children, and the youngest, growing up, he sort of had this shadow of shame that came from, you know, so many different things, probably how the school standards were, I don't know. But I was so worried about that. And then I threw him in sports, in the sports world, and that changed everything. But in shame, in your experience, is there a common element? What that is caused from? Is it basically similar in many people or not?
Well, no, I think the core wounding that creates shame, like in my mind, again, you alerted, you know, that I do, I'm a Christian, I believe in God. And so I think basically the root of shame is us forgetting that our core identity is a person who's unconditionally loved by God, or we could even say something greater than ourselves. And so shame comes in and masks that, and it makes us think that we're simply not good enough. And that usually comes from, you know, in my own life, just I would say humiliations as a child, living up to the expectations of a parent, and those things. And you can be victimized, like a person who's suffered trauma. Yes. And, you know, yes, I've had some trauma in my life, and that creates shame. And that masks the truth that we are, each one of us is loved unconditionally by the God that created us. And if we can just live out of that space, we could live, you know, substantially apart from shame. And I'll share like one of my favorite kind of disarming statements about shame. Like, and this was really hard for me at first. One of my mentors years ago said that we should just say this one line prayer. And it's simply this, God, help me believe the truth about myself, no matter how beautiful it is.
Yes, I understand. Perfect.
And that's a shame cracker, because most of the time you think, oh, geez, the truth about myself, I don't even want to talk about that. But then that's how beautiful it is. And that gets us to that deep reality.
Yeah. The notion of unconditional is what I battle with the people I work with, and I mentor and I coach. And it's many people just can't wrap their head around that. And even without the notion of unconditional love from a God, but their ability to love unconditionally, which is, you know, I imagine that it stems from, it's just like a cat that bites its tail, really. Because if you don't believe that from above, you're unable to then give that, I think,
Well, I think that's true. I think sometimes you get two reactions. Like I actually do, I think in general, that's true, but you also can get this strange thing. Like I noticed in my life before I had this transformation that's probably ultimately brought me onto your show here today, yeah, was that I was able to love other people, but I did it to detriment of myself.
Give me an example, if you don't mind.
I think what I mean by that is the scriptures, and this is almost a universal truth, I think, right, you find in a lot of religions, but there's the idea of love your neighbor as yourself.
Right.
Some of us love our neighbor more than we love ourselves. And what that does is it slowly depletes us. So yes, like for an instance, like I can, just honestly say, I think I had, and I've kind of been growing, so I'm not going to say I'm cured from these things, but I think I had kind of codependent enabling tendencies.
Right.
And so I wouldn't show up fully. Like I could serve a person powerfully, but I wouldn't show up in those contexts as my authentic self and say things that maybe that I really believe, because I didn't want to hurt the other person, or I was afraid I was going to lose the other person in some way. So I would say in some ways I loved people. Again, was that perfectly unconditional? Probably not. But in my brain, I was loving another, but it wasn't coming out of the wholeness of who I was, if that makes sense.
Yes.
Or who I truly was.
Yes, it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. Very interesting, that is. Really, really interesting. Now, I'd like to say to myself, well, we got rid of the bad stuff. Now let's get into the good stuff.
Yeah.
The umbrella of everything that I think we'll be talking about can be classified under spiritual practices, but I like to detail them. And you suggested the notion of silence and solitude as being good for our souls. Maybe you can clarify, and I'm going to ask you a terrible thing to do, please forgive me, the notion of a soul, because a lot of people don't get that. And why then are solitude and silence good for that?
Yeah, and I can clarify this a couple of different ways. I'm not a person that's like a necessarily what you'd call a dualist. In some ways, I am materialist in the way I understand the soul and the body. Like I think it's we're talking about speculation, and we're talking about spiritual things.
Sure.
And so in my mind, I never want to separate my spirituality from my body per se. And so it's possible to, cause like, I don't think you can pull the soul out of me. I would say that what a soul is, it's a living body that's in spirit. So I'll just say it that way. So when I talk about soul, I'm really talking about the fullest version of who we are.
Yeah.
I would say, I think that's important. Beautiful. To say. Mm-hmm. And so when I talk about how silence is good for us, or for our souls, it's very much talking about understanding our own bodily responses to things as well. And so what silence does is, and again, this is apart from whether there's actually a God or not, because this is going to be true for anybody that does silence or solitude, is you're going to be confronted in the because of the silence.
Yes.
With bodily sensations,
yes,
feelings, and if you're really attentive, the thoughts that are buzzing around in your mind that oftentimes you're not even conscious of. And so being forced into silence apart from distraction, you discover what's really inside of yourself. And in my mind, that's a gift from God, who's inviting us to embrace love and our true identity by essentially releasing that stuff that shows up on the inside when we're in the silence. And, so if you want to find out what I'm always curious, what is it that I'm afraid to feel is one of my favorite questions to ask myself, you know, like, why am I, if I'm working too much, what am I trying to avoid by working too much?
I love that.
I mean, that's because that's what silence does. And, you know, yeah. And people have different ways of filling the void in their life when there's no silence. You know, work is one thing, you know, so you can do, you can hobbies, you can do things that aren't good for you. That's where a lot, in my mind, a lot of addictions come from, the attempting to avoid the feelings, but silence lets you confront all that. And if you can just hold on to the discomfort that does come over time with silence, on the other side of that, again, isn't perfection, but it's substantial healing and some real freedom that lets you show up then in the world as a person who's not afraid of who you really are.
There you go. You link the healing right to that. Beautiful, beautifully put. Very, very erudite. I love that. That was fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, you're welcome. It's a great question you asked. So that's awesome.
There's also, you mentioned to me rhythms, creating certain rhythms that I initially thought, could they be equated to habits? But yes. I like the notion of rhythms because of the harmony and because of the movement that it implies. The rhythms for thriving and flourishing in our daily life and work, our businesses.
Yeah, and these are words that are interchangeable. Like if you go into kind of classic spiritual formation, you'll hear words like setting up a rule of life for yourself. That came out of like the monastic.
Hold on. When you say a classical formation, are you talking about seminaries or?
Not necessarily. I was just saying that I was going to explain where I get the word rhythm from. So basically, if you look in this Christian spiritual tradition, you'll have people talking about things like setting up a rule of life, or you also hear there's books on spiritual disciplines. In secular culture, we have things about habits. I love that word rhythm, and you picked it up well, that there's a kind of a beauty to it, because not everybody likes discipline.
Right, exactly.
And even habits. But when you think about rhythm, that's just, it's more, that makes your life more like a dance, if you will.
Right, exactly.
And so, but you still need to have recognize, you know, like we have seasons, right? And different seasons bring different things. So I like to think of the way that I live my life on a day-to-day basis, going through different seasons. And so what do I need to kind of practice habitually that lets me essentially show up? Well, like one of my mentors said, show up, pay attention, and recognize that as I interact with other people and go about my work, that I would, in my mind, that God has more invested in all this than I do. And so how do I show up as my best version of myself? Most of the time, and it's most of the time, I got to say, Claudia, because I have bad days too.
Yeah.
And maybe it's only some of the time, honestly, but I want it to be most of the time. most of the time.
I could listen to you all day. before you dove into that, you did mention role that's common when you in certain fields of study or how or that you have gone through. People know role, people understand roles, and people come to me with the question, what is my purpose, what am I to do, what role am I to have? And I wanted to go back, and maybe you could clarify that notion of role in that you mentioned previously before going on to the rhythms.
Yeah. And I think, and I actually said rule of life. I don't know if you heard role.
That's why I asked for a definition. I couldn't understand it.
Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry about that. I can talk about roles too, because that flows out of that, but in the context I was saying rule, I'm happy to talk about role, because that's the whole thing. Like I actually think rhythms and of life, the whole point of that is to set us up.
Yes.
So that we can, you know, offer our highest good and our highest gifts to the world in service to other people. And so when I say purpose, like, I, you know, shorthand, I think the ultimate purpose in life is to love. And what I would mean that, love God, love neighbor, and love ourselves. That's the purpose. Now that's so broad that that's not particularly helpful.
Yeah.
But within that context, once I recognize that I'm a person loved by God, I can, without shame, allow the music that's in me, if we want to use that as a metaphor, to sing, or I can get the book that's in me to come out, or whatever I'm really good at. And I can make that my offering to the world as much as I possibly can. Because in my view, every single person on the planet, it has dignity before God, is loved by God, and there's something that each person has that if they could get it out of themselves and offer to the world, would make the world more beautiful. And so when I think about purpose and role, that's how I would think about it. Yeah. And I think these spiritual practices could help each one of us individually to discover what that is and live it out, you know, most of the time or even some of the time on a consistent basis.
Brian, I'm going to ask you to do something that you may not be prepared for, but I trust that you'll be fine with it. Today, even with this high-powered pace that people live in, and even in the, you know, behind Zoom life that we're living in now in the COVID period, there still is what I feel, no matter what kind of profession you're in or what kind of service you offer, things travel by word of mouth and communication. No matter how much advertising you do, people talk to other people. Now, let's say that a person in Florida, not necessarily very close to you, but was told by a friend, he was especially, I'll call him a man, you know, especially depressed. And he said, you know, I know that you're not very religious generally, but I know this man, and he mentions your name. It would be good if you could have a talk with him. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now he comes to you. Let's call him Joe Brian. And he comes to you, and there's a number of issues. You know, there's family issues. There is, are his professional issues. There are health issues, and those are similar in nature, but quite different. But fundamentally, he is depressed, and he's forgotten even why, you know, because it's been so long. So where would you start? Because remember, he's not specific. He has had no background in religion at all. Was an orphan, let's say. Okay.
No, that's a great conversation. Now, obviously, just from as a coach or even from my pastor perspective, if somebody's super depressed, I'm probably going to try to get them to go see a psychotherapist or a psychologist. I'll say that. But what I would do, and this is true, is like, I speak with anybody. I start just at a ground level. I would essentially ask the person, if they were coming to me, is my first thing is I come with a heart of service. So I would say, Joe, what would make this conversation extraordinarily helpful for you today? And I'm just going to listen for what they're saying. Again, I'm kind of intuitive when I talk to somebody. So I'm just trying to look for patterns in their language to see where they are and to see how I can really serve them. And I'm going to serve them best by asking them questions to draw out, hopefully, a future. And then like one of my favorite questions, and I actually got this from, I think a coach I heard on a podcast, his name was Dan Sullivan, but like he always, and this is a version of his question, so I'm not going to say this is a quote from him, but I'm going to give the credit to where I got this idea, was he always says, I would say, Joe, let's imagine that after today, I don't see you, and you could say a year, you could say 3 years, mm-hmm. What would have to be true 1 year from now or 3 years from now? If we talked again and you'd said, hey, Brian, you won't believe what's happened. And so I would try to help them to imagine a future, and then to see how I could come alongside to really serve them powerfully, to be a partner with them to try to walk towards that future. So I'm always trying to help people to imagine a future, which to me, you're only going to get to by getting through the junk in your life that's brought you to the moment where you're stuck, and open yourself up to something bigger. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. And you haven't even touched on one religious notion. If we could, you haven't said the word God to this person at all. And it wasn't necessary. And this is interesting. It's very, very interesting. When you talk about mentoring, what form does that take in your practice? Do you mentor a certain age group, what is the typical mentorship for you?
Yeah. And again, you know, my mentoring came out of my longstanding role as a professor. So I've been teaching now, this is going to be my 23rd academic year as a professor. So literally it's in graduate school. So I've taught probably over 1,000 students by this time, if not more. I've never counted all of them. And I've essentially had all ages. So I'm pretty comfortable with all ages. I'm 52 myself, and I still know I get students that are older than me. And then, you know, I get students, probably the youngest would be like 22. So I work with a wide range of ages, which has given me a great deal of perspective, because you can learn things from talking to people that are, you know, different ages. But to be real specific, I think my sweet spot is, and I think that when you're in this kind of work, you tend to attract people that need the thing that you have in some ways.
Yes.
And so I would say my sweet spot would be, persons, and they don't have to be a certain age, but it's typically like at least 40, you know, so let's say 40 to 60 that are hard chargers that have worked super hard and then feel a profound dissatisfaction where they are and are trying to reboot before they just shut down and say, wow, my life just didn't work out the way that I've done. So I've helped people rebound from like divorces, which was my own personal experience. Or losing their job and trying to rebuild, or making a jump from one career to another. And then I also run into persons who've had success, but they're looking for what's missing. And what I find often it's missing is this idea of transcendence. And this is where the work that I do on with the spiritual practices. And again, this is whether you're a Christian or not, can really help. Because the things I teach, I mean, again, as a Christian, you know, I hope I can share my faith in some ways, but that's not my job. And I work with persons wherever they are. And that's the commitment I make to the people I work with. But I do like to help people experience a bigger life, which I think involves spirituality. And most people are open to that, and they know where I'm coming from. And so if someone would be like offended by my Christian practices, they probably wouldn't work with me in the first place.
Of course.
Yeah.
I'm going to go into your professorship, all right, of biblical studies. And by the way, I've been at it for 40. So I've seen many more students than you at my university.
It's awesome.
I started very young. So when you, the Bible is a big piece of work.
Yes.
I follow the Bible in a Year podcast. I just goes one lesson, and it's incredibly bloody and incredibly cruel and incredibly, you know, and of course I grew up listening to these things and then now reading, and I love the stories. I do really love the stories, but I still, in my mind, I have not the idea very clear of how it was created. I do have it, and it's systematized, but what kind of classes do you give? Are there different classes for different levels, or is it just a course that's that people choose? Is it an undergraduate course that they can opt or optional? You know, what kind of classes are they?
Yeah, no, this is a great question. And what I am, I teach at a theological seminary, which means the people that are coming are actually, in some ways, they feel, they sense a calling to either be a pastor or, you know, we have a mental health counseling degree at my institution. We have leadership degrees, but they're all graduate degrees. And so people are sort of self-selected and say, you know what, I'm going to go a little bit deeper. But what it means to study biblical studies is we have a core that everybody has to take. And so everybody, but basically what I do is I teach a class, me personally, I teach introduction to Old Testament. So I offer history, theology, and a review of the literature.
Sure.
And then, for pastors, one of the things that pastor or priest is going to do is, you know, they do a sermon and they teach, right? So they have to be able to, so I teach interpretation courses, basically. The fancy word would be hermeneutics or exegesis.
Yes, hermeneutics,
But I essentially just teach people how to read an ancient document so that you can make it applicable to a 21st century audience. So that's a lot of the work that I do. And so like for myself, I teach classes on the book of Exodus. That was part of what my PhD was on, or the book of Psalms. Mm-hmm. And I do some New Testament stuff. My title is Professor of Biblical Studies, because when I first was hired in Orlando, I was the only Bible professor. So I had to teach the whole Bible. And so they gave me that title. So I mostly teach Old Testament courses. Mm-hmm. And I teach Hebrew and Greek also. So I know that the original languages for that. So that's basically, I'm preparing, here's how I like to say it for a lay audience or persons who may not even be Christian, is my job is to make sure that when a person teaches or preaches out of the Bible, they're not oppressing people with the scriptures, when the Bible is supposed to be this liberating message about God's love for the world, ultimately through Jesus's life, death, and resurrection.
That's really difficult.
Because obviously the people have justified all kinds of unspeakably bad things in the name of scripture. And they've also, obviously, a lot of the powerfully wonderful things in the Western world have come about because of the message of scripture. But my job is to help people sort that out so we get the good minus some misappropriations of what the scriptures would say.
Oh, well, that's a tall order. That really is a tall order, but it's fascinating, fascinating. Really, really fascinating. How many students in a typical year, incoming, let's talk about incoming students, new students come in at the first level?
Yeah, and this will probably be a little bit surprising. Seminaries aren't big.
No, I imagine.
Now our school is one of the bigger seminaries in the country. But having said that, my daughter goes to the University of Florida, and they take 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 people a year, freshmen or whatever. So a big class for us would be, I'm going to say somewhere around 300. So
that's a lot. I was thinking 150. That's what I was thinking.
And that's typical. Like most seminaries actually get less than 100 people every year. So that's why I said we're pretty good size, but that's, we just happen to be one of the biggest. I mean, we're on the Methodist side of the Christian family, on the Protestant side. So So we draw people from the Methodist side of things, and we're probably the biggest. Mm-hmm. Again, we're non-denominational, but we're the biggest Methodist flavored seminary that's in the world.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. I never thought of the flavors. Yeah. I can see that.
Cause there's Roman Catholic seminaries, there's Presbyterian, there's Baptist, there's all these different things. And so,
Well, it's been so, so pleasant to talk to you. And I'd like to have you back sometime, in the fall, even early next year. When things change a little bit and we'll be up, we could update the conversation. That would be really, really nice for me. And I'd like you to, though, I know that you're writing, you have a book that's out, I believe, and maybe you could tell us talk about that, and also tell the audience where they can find you, if you have a website or connect in social media or any place that you can be contacted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I have a book. It releases, I'm not sure when we're releasing this, but it'll be out on September the 14th of 2021. And it's called Centering Prayer. Sitting quietly in God's presence can change your life. And in that book, I detail the transformation that took place in my life by really embracing the silence, just like we talked about earlier in the conversation. And it's a book written to help people learn to do silent meditative prayer. And a lot of the listeners, I know you said you've had people over the world. Yes. So it's basically what I'd say, it's a book about Christian meditation. Mm-hmm. And so if folks are familiar with mindfulness meditation, it's similar to that, but it's got a distinctively Christian version, because I'm trying to sit with God. Mm-hmm. And it's a book about what happens when you do sit in silence, what you're going to experience, and how the silence, and I would say God is behind this, can slowly help you heal on the inside so that you can show up in the outer world and be fully present to others, more loving, calm, able to catch yourself before you say something that maybe you wish you wouldn't have said. Yes, and just, yes. and in my own life, I found it's made me more curious, less judgmental. And, you know, even in my role as a coach, I wouldn't have done any coaching and I probably never would have met you if I wouldn't have experienced the benefits of a long-term meditation practice. And just to give the angle that I run through the book is, you know, I discovered, well, silence found me versus me finding silence. Cause I went through at some level, at one point it was a devastating divorce back in 2010 and 11 after a 20-year marriage that I wasn't expecting. And it pretty much fried me completely. Yeah, absolutely. So, and so this book is, in a sense, I use my own example of how the silence transformed me while simultaneously teaching the insights, you know, the best practices, even the stuff, the obstacles that I found as I was doing this practice. So that's the book. And again, it comes out on September 14th. If people are interested in finding out about the book, they can get it on Amazon or they can go to a website that I set up, centeringprayerbook.com, and I can give you some information. Now, if you just want to reach out and find out more about me, I have a brand new website that's out in as of August of 2021. It's brianrussellphd.com.
Oh, interesting. brianrussellphd.com. I like it. But I also know that you have your own podcast. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I started a podcast literally right at the beginning of lockdown from the COVID-19
like many
stuff.
People,
because I always wanted to have one. And I'm like, well, now I got this extra time. I don't got to drive to work. So I started, it's called Deep Dive Spirituality Conversations. And I speak with authors and spiritual leaders who are experts really at spiritual formation, mission, and leadership, and especially people that can combine those three things. And so that comes out every week. And my program that I do with pastors is called Deep Dive Spirituality Coaching. And so that it kind of supports that. But that's what my podcast is. And folks can find that on YouTube or anywhere else they find podcasts. It's Deep Dive Spirituality Conversations.
Yeah, in the mainstream Apple podcasts and Spotify, I imagine that shows up. Well, thank you so much. Next time we talk again, I'd like to talk about God more in depth. Good. And because everyone talks and asks me, well, what do you think? And what do you think that? And I always say, I could tell you what I think today. I don't know what I will be thinking tomorrow.
That's good.
So we'll update our conversation. Thanks again, Brian, for coming.
No, thank you, Claudia. It's such a privilege to be here, and I just appreciate the conversation today.
We'll talk again then. Bye-bye.
Bye.